case of Tyrone West and represents Tyrone West's family. So thank you, LaToya. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, when we come back, the eulogy for Freddie Gray, delivered by the Reverend Jamal Bryant, that rocked the church, community, and city. Stay with us.
Ago on this very day, January 27th, the door swung open to the prison in Jacksonville, Florida, and walking out with all of her esteem intact was Marissa Alexander, Florida mother whose case became a rallying cry for survivors of domestic violence and a sterling example of inequity for activists whose intention is to break the prison pipeline. After facing a potential 60 years behind bars for firing a single warning shot in the vicinity of her abusive husband, she ended up serving 3 unjust years while her abuser never spent a night. She was manipulated into pleading guilty, and in exchange for time served, she finds herself, while we are in this sanctuary, confined to house arrest for 2 years on electronic surveillance monitoring, or as we would call it in urban centers, the box. One of the greatest tragedies in life is to think that you are free, but to still be confined to a box. Living in a box of stereotypes, other people's opinion, sweeping generalizations, and racial profiling. The box of thinking all black men are thugs and athletes and rappers. To think that black people are syphilis and don't have a work ethic. Absence of integrity, a conscience, and even a soul. It's a hard thing, and one of the hardest things that you'll ever endure in life is trying to break out of a box that unjustified people try to put you in. Sociologists have unearthed a newfound phenomenon called quarter life crisis that insists that this generation of youth in their mid-20s begin meandering through the painstaking task of asking themselves, What am I going to do with my life? Is there any hope for me? What should I have done differently? Grandmother, I need you to know that Freddie had to have been in a quarter midlife crisis. Because at 25 years of age, being black in Baltimore, no opportunities to go to Johns Hopkins, no doors open at the University of Maryland, no scholarship to Morgan, and no access to Coppin. He had to have been asking himself, what am I going to do with my life? In a place where I have minimal opportunities, Freddie had to have asked, when I can walk down the harbor and see Exelon, Under Armour, when it is that I can look across the water and see millions of dollars poured into Camden Yards and M&T Stadium. He had to have asked himself, what am I going to do with my life? Will there be given to me an opportunity to raise and to support a family? And he had to have felt at 25 years of age that the walls were coming in on him. He had to feel almost like he was boxed in. And on April the 12th at 8:39 in the morning, four officers on bicycles saw your son. And your son, in a subtlety of revolutionary stance, did something black men were trained to tell no not to do. He looked police in the eye. And when he looked the police in the eye, they knew that there was a threat. Because they're used to black men with their head bowed down low, with their spirit broken. He was a threat simply because he was man enough to look somebody in authority in the eye. I want to tell this grieving mother, you want to have your post checked out, because you are not burying a boy, you are burying a grown man. We knew that one of the principles of being a man is looking somebody in the eye. At 8:40, your son began running from the police. He began running at 8:41. According to the timeline, he stopped. He stopped not because he was out of breath. He stopped not because he was a weakling. He stopped not because asthma had kicked in. He stopped because somewhere within the inner recesses of his own mind, he made up in his mind, I'm tired of living in a box. And so he stopped running. Ladies and gentlemen, over the last 7 days, you have seen throngs of young black men and women walking down Mount Street and walking down North Avenue, turning down to Holiday Street, making up in their mind, I am not surrendering, I'm marching. I'm marching because there is, before gangster rap music, there was the Negro spiritual. Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. And that's why, even under the imminent threat of arrest and tear gas, they still kept marching. And ladies and gentlemen, Ecclesiastes aptly reminds us that there is nothing new under the sun. And so as we jaywalk in our text, we notice that Jesus and his disciples are coming to an unknown hamlet of a town, no name. But if you look at the autopsy of the text, you'll notice that name is somewhat reminiscent of this place called Baltimore. Because he saw large crowds gathering downtown. And they were marching. And while they were marching, they were protesting, and they're carrying a dead young man's body. And outside of that casket is a mother who's grieving, and five weeping sisters, and a father who's standing strong, and a stepfather who in pain can still find poetry. A grandmother who even while grieving can hold on to grace. And Jesus is overwhelmed by this crowd, and he stops as he's seeing the funeral processional. And ladies and gentlemen, we notice that Luke somehow or another is obscure in his writing. He's abstract in his information, and I'm not sure whether or not Luke is writing for the Baltimore Sun of his day. Because Luke tells us that the young man died, but Luke never tells us how. And isn't it amazing, ladies and gentlemen, that America is in a strange place of a matrix, because we always like to look at what, but we don't like to ask why. So it's easy for the news to capture young people rioting and looting. It's easy to show that, but you ain't ever gonna say why. We don't know whether or not this young man in Luke chapter 7 has died because of asthma. But nobody asked why. Maybe it's because of lead paint poisoning. We don't know why it is that he died. It could have been from excessive force by the police department of Rome. We don't know whether or not, I have absolutely no idea if it was because he didn't have on a seatbelt. All I know is that he died. And somewhere I hear the sound of Claude McKay writing from a one-bedroom apartment in the middle of the Harlem Renaissance. If we must die, let us nobly die. Let it not be like hogs hunted and pinned in an inglorious spot that make their mark out of a cursed lot. If we must die. And Jesus walks up to this mother. And contrary to what Congressman Cummings has admonished us peaceably to do, Jesus says to this mother, don't cry. Whatever you do, don't cry. It's a strange prescription to tell a family in pain, don't cry. When the Bible declares that weeping may endure for a night and joy comes in the morning, he says to the mother, don't cry. He was saying almost as a prophetic witness, I don't want you to cry because I want you to stop looking like what's getting ready to happen. If you cry, people are going to get confused and think justice is not going to come. But I came to tell this grandmother, I came to tell the aunt, I came to tell Freddie Senior, I came to tell Freddie's five sisters, don't cry. And the reason why I want you not to cry is because Freddie's death is not in vain. After this day, we're going to keep on marching. After this day, we're going to keep demanding justice. After this day, we're going to keep exposing a culture of corruption. After this day, we're going to keep monitoring our own neighborhood. Whatever you do, don't cry. Amazingly, Jesus does something. He lifts up his hand. And he changes the position of healer. Because Bishop Thomas, every other time that Jesus is healed, it has always been a lateral move. He would reach his hand out. But when we find ourselves in this narrative for the very first time in sacred scripture, Jesus lifts his hands up. And when he lifts his hands up, he touches the casket. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know where you are in this place, whether you're watching on the news or in this sacred space I'm called sanctuary, but I'm praying to God that God will lay his hand on everything that's been trying to keep black people in a box. I don't know whether I'm talking about redlining of zip codes or gentrification, or whether I'm talking about a prison pipeline or inadequate public schools, but whatever that has been placed around the life and the future of young black babies in this city, I pray, God, put your hand on the box. I said to the young man, without the benefit of the instructions of what he did in the miracle for Lazarus, he never told anybody, roll the stone away. But he said, watch this, to this young man in the box still, get up. It is almost like Dr. Dyson, that he is channeling in a prophetic mantle the legacy of Marcus Garvey. Up, you mighty people, accomplish what you will. This is not the time for us as a people to be sitting on a corner drinking malt liquor. This is not the time for us to be playing lottery or to be at the Horseshoe Casino. This is not the time for us to be walking around with our pants hanging down, passed out by
to get up. In spite of Governor Hogan reducing funding for public schools, I need you to get up. In spite of the fact that they spend more money on special education than they do on gifted and talented programs, get yourself up. In spite of what they told you you ought to be and what you are going to become, get up. You are not Little Wayne. You are not Little Boosie. You are in the mantle and the legacy of Thurgood Marshall and Clarence Mitchell Sr. and Perrin Mitchell and Kwaisi Mfume. Get your black self up and change this city.
He speaks to the boy while he's still in the box. And the reason that makes me shout, preachers, is that even while he's in a box, he can still hear God's voice. And there's somebody in this room that can thank God that even while my back was up against the wall, I could still hear God's voice. That's why as a people, we've been able to maintain our faith even after the Middle Passage, even after Jim Crow, even after Reaganomics, even after Assembly Speaker Bush, we can still say over my head, I hear music in the air, and there must be a God somewhere. I don't know what Jesus you serve, but the Jesus I serve is not blonde with blue eyes, but the Jesus I serve looks just like Freddie Gray, and that Jesus is the Jesus who will lift us up again.
He says to this young man, get up. And he never opens the casket. You missed what I just said. He tells the young man, get up, while he's in a closed casket. He was sending a message to Black America. Don't expect nobody to open the door for you. If they don't open the door, kick that sucker down.
He was supposed to be dead. Supposed to be over. And he got up without any prompting, ladies and gentlemen, and he started talking. I don't know how you can be black in America and be silent. With everything that we've been through, ain't no way in the world you can sit here and be silent in the face of injustice. With everything that we're dealing with our children being gunned down in the streets, I don't know how y'all being bougie and acting like you can't give God glory. But if God ever brought you through anything, you ought to open up your mouth and give him glory.
Pray just like this boy in Luke chapter 7. He broke out of the box. And again, Luke, the gospel writer and physician, has let me down. Because when the boy broke out of the box, he forgot to tell me what that boy said. Getting out of the casket. But if you'll allow me to validate my sanctified imagination, when that black boy got out of the casket, do you want to know what he said? He said, no justice! No justice! No justice!
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. And you just heard the Reverend Jamal Bryant, pastor of the Empowerment Temple AME Church in Baltimore, giving the eulogy at Freddie Gray's funeral on Monday. When we come back, why Freddie Gray's death has also sparked calls for economic justice. Stay with us.
You are let's do it. I lift my hands in total praise to you. Everybody say you are
the source of my strength.
Come on, you can sing it.
And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on 89.3 Washington WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. I'm Esther Averam, and we're continuing our discussion about the death of Freddie Gray and its aftermath. Joining me for this segment is Alan Clifford, known to everyone as Brother Cliff. Cliff is a native Washingtonian. He's educated at the University of Life, including Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, and other street institutions. He currently serves as a facilitator on issues affecting the African diaspora and publishes the Kuwumba Report online. Welcome, Brother Cliff.
Thank you for inviting me to come on the show tonight, this afternoon.
Well, is it afternoon? I think it's still morning.
It's morning. It feels like afternoon to me.
Right. So, I guess more so than other cases that we've covered related to police brutality and killing, you know, the death of Freddie Gray, and I tried to get to this earlier in the show, is more than the other cases, this case is being connected to the issues of economic justice. And I wanted to talk to you as a lifelong resident of the, you know, a longtime resident of the Baltimore area, about some of those economic issues.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to Linda Sarsour last week. She was one of the organizers of this tremendous march to justice that went from New York to Washington. There were like 100 activists marching 250 miles. And she's a Palestinian American. She has relatives in Gaza, in occupied Palestine. And she said when she walked through the neighborhood where some of this occurred, it looked like an occupied area. The abandonment, the lots, empty lots, you know, the boarded up buildings. And so from your perspective, you know, having seen it up close for many years, what are some of the issues that perhaps we don't know about and that the larger corporate media certainly is not focusing on in terms of covering this in terms of economic justice?
Well, first of all, we've heard all of the public officials from Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake all the way up to the national level talking about looting and thugs and all these sort of things. And it's gotten to the point now where I think a lot of people are seeing those as code words for something else that, of course, you cannot say on public television or even on radio these days without starting a fight. But they referred to the looting that occurred. There are a few things that occur to me about that particular characterization. Yesterday I was watching television and one young man was interviewed and he was asked, for example, why the CVS pharmacy that was there at the corner of Pennsylvania and North Avenues was looted. And he said that the reason why that particular place was looted was because they didn't feel that it had a connection to the community. By contrast, you go a half block east on North Avenue, there were two businesses side by side. There was another pharmacy, which wasn't totally destroyed, but it was attacked to some degree. Right next door, attached to it, was a bookstore. The bookstore is called Everyone's Place. It is owned by a brother named Baba Nati.
Right.
And everyone in that neighborhood knew who Baba Natee was, know who he is. They know the connection everyone's place has with that community. And from first a picture that I saw on Facebook, and then when a friend of mine and I went to the store yesterday afternoon, that place was untouched.
Right.
There was another business across the street, which didn't have bars or anything, a large plate glass window, untouched. And a number of people were saying, the people in that area know who's with them and know who's not with them. They might make a mistake here and there, but obviously there were some people who were aware of those businesses that they have a connection with, and they left them alone. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, with all these officials talking about looters, they act as though this is the first instance of looting that they have ever seen. Every time that there is a major disturbance, and we go all the way back, at least back to Rodney King. I mean, there have been tons of young brothers who have been executed in the streets since the time of Rodney King. And you see people in these depressed neighborhoods rising up in essentially a culmination of rage that had been boiling within them for years and years and years and years and years. I mean, you go down to L.A. and South Central, what did you have there? You had a depressed neighborhood. You had a neighborhood that Gary Webb of the San Jose Mercury News had already exposed as having been a target for drug production, drug distribution by the United States Central Intelligence Agency. So we already knew that area had been essentially targeted for exploitation, even by the government that now calls the people who were going through the streets and burning things looters.
Right.
Okay, some of them were engaged in senseless acts of violence. I don't condone those things, but at the same time, we have to understand in context, especially urban African American communities have essentially been looted.
Yes.
For decades, at least for decades. Mm-hmm. They have been subject to wherever you have black people in a large concentration, it seems that there's some degree of looting going on, whether it's in urban areas where rec centers are closed so that now you don't have an outlet for your aggression. Schools are closed, libraries are closed.
Just stop and talk about that for a minute, because a lot of people who aren't in the city don't understand the significance of the rec centers and how they've been closed and the budget priorities that came about.
Yeah. Well, the rec centers and the libraries and the schools, to my mind, go hand in hand. The schools, of course, are where our young people go to be taught or to learn. And the schools are closed in many cases, and then the children are sometimes sent to the charter schools, which are now largely privatized schools. That is automatically going to shut some of those students out of getting into that charter school, because in many cases you got to have a little something to get in there. Okay, so now they're economically pushed out of a lot of the charter schools, and then the public schools no longer there for them to attend. Then when you are faced with the kind of economic depression that a lot of these people are faced with, there was a brother in a community meeting last week who was talking about a lot of the families in Gilmore Homes, and that's where young Freddie Gray lived and where he was arrested and where he received the injuries that essentially led to his death. He said that there are families that are living in that neighborhood that have been in a state of economic depression for generations.
Right. I've actually just recently just come to the realization or that when you talk about looting, and it came back to my mind when you saw these scenes on television and I'm talking about the looters, when you talk about generations of poverty and depression, it's like generations of looting. Mm-hmm. I know that, for example, Baltimore was hit heavily by the substandard, the last economic meltdown, mm-hmm. where these substandard mortgages were pushed onto people.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the blight that we see in Baltimore has come from that. And
right.
People have not recovered from that. So that is like a more of a modern day looting, you know. So
yeah.
When you talk about looting, you know, I've just started thinking about just the long-term, the long-term aspect of that, not just one CVS store or one night of grabbing some Pampers or something out of a store, but what is the long-term looting, like you said, that's been going on.
Wells Fargo Bank was, I think, actually charge. I don't know how that case wound up, but I know that they were taken to court for A, redlining African American communities, and then B, funneling African American would-be homeowners into these subprime loans that wound up being packaged with the junk, with a lot of other junk, and being traded on Wall Street, which was part of what led to the 2008 crash. There are a number of people who thought they had money, and they moved out to large houses out in the outskirts of the city. We were a little smarter when we made our move, but other people, $700,000, oh, well, the realtor says I can afford it, so I'll go ahead and do it. And so they get into the $700,000 house, and 1 year later they're in foreclosure. So these are people who think they are upwardly mobile, but even that is an upward mobility based on the accumulation of debt. When you have a situation where the average wage of a worker in the United States has essentially, real wages have been frozen since the 1970s, and that at the same time, expenses keep going up, up, up. You're expected to move yourself up in the world. The only way you can do it is through debt. So then people get into economic debt that way, and then they wind up losing everything down the road, and it blindsides a lot of them.
You know, Mike, I meant to make a call to see if anyone wanted to call in today. So you can certainly join us by calling 202-588-0893. I think our phones may still have some challenges, but we can try. 202-588-0893 is the number to call. So I know you were at a discussion here in Silver Spring last night. I know Freddie Gray came up as a subject, right?
Well, he comes up everywhere.
Right. So this was in Silver Spring at the Firehouse One restaurant, right? And this is a regular event happening. So what are some of the things that people are talking about, and what are some of the solutions that people see right now? I know there was a coalition that had organized around taking legislation to Annapolis, and much of that legislation was defeated.
Right.
But before we get to that, let me take a caller.
Since
I'm able to today. Good morning. Welcome to the show. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
I'm Reverend Akeem Potter from Boston. It's good to hear everybody that's participating in your show. And good to hear you give a breath of this whole dialogue. You know, I think that he mentioned Matthew's show, store every Wednesday. I was there Thursday, you know, and I'm 65 years old, you know, and I was part of the rise of 68. I mean, I was alive when that happened. The point I'm making, and many other things I'm considering an activist, my name is Dakeem Napata. And the point I'm making is this. The show that preceded you and me and Matthew's show, we must make sure that, as you're doing now, opening the lines up, that we get a breath of what's going on. Gilmore Homes is the first oldest housing project in America. The second oldest is McCullough Home, both in Baltimore. Carmelo Anthony came out of Gilmore from New York at 7 down to Gilmore. The best decision. I was a kid. Him and his trainer and his father was a good friend of mine, Richard Bryan. The point I'm making is, you know, you gave a lot of time to Jamal, and I was there at the funeral and Jesse Jackson, and everybody, all the leaders in the life. It did not give adequate time for young people to express themselves, you know, and that's what they're doing. I'm not trying to down any. I went to Douglas High School, was a quarterback on the basketball team, you know, and an alumni, you know, the point and Howard. The point I'm making is this, that when we don't give young people an opportunity to express themselves, it's very easy for celebrity preachers, and I'm going to say it again, celebrity preachers from mega churches, right, who rate the community in tithes and do nothing in the community, to show up, you know, and talk about, you know, what we ought to be doing and how to interpret. The boy's pastor, who's from Gilmore, wasn't allowed to really give expression.
Okay. Know? Okay. Thank you. And we have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Tespa calling from Arlington. I just want to say, may Freddie West rest in peace. May black people in America, in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Rwanda, not rest until we get freedom and justice from dictators the United States installed. Thank you very much.
Okay, and we have another caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
First name is Paul, and I'm calling from Upper Marlboro right now. And I just want to say that there are a number of things that really, I think, this whole incident is showing. One, as many people have talked about before, the corruption inside of the Democratic Party and the politicians inside the city of Baltimore as well as Washington, D.C., where they're giving all kinds of tax breaks to the rich developers and then turn around saying they don't have money for education, they don't have money for recreation, they don't have money to address the needs of people who have worked very hard in their jurisdiction, and the idea is just pushing them out of the city and saying we don't need to be responsible for you anymore.
Okay, so thank you for that call. And we always have so much jammed into 1 hour.
Oh, yeah.
And I just want to give you a chance to, you know, any final comments.
Okay. Well, first of all, what Paul just said is correct as far as the points that he was making. Baba Daki Napata, I know Baba Daki Napata, and he is a very committed activist in the Baltimore area. And when he refers to, especially as far as who gets the attention and who does not, Reverend Bryan has delivered a really fiery eulogy, and he's gained a reputation as being one of the preachers in Baltimore that is connected to the community, but there are others. Pastor Heber Bryan of Pleasant Hope is probably the first name I think of in terms of a preacher who is activist enough to not only get involved on the front lines, but also to apologize for the degree to which the church has done some of the things Baba Daki said. Mm-hmm. The brother from Arlington, as far as the connecting that to the economic piece, not only are we looted in our neighborhoods, but black farmers have land stolen from them in North Carolina. African farmers have land stolen from them in the continent. Black people are being looted and being dispossessed of their land through gentrification, through land seizures for corporations and foreign governments. Everywhere there is a black person,
mm-hmm.
stuff is being taken from us. Our land is being looted. Our property is being looted. And when the young people use the normal channels, every time someone is murdered, they use the normal channels to protest, and they're shown a deaf ear. They're
right.
shown a deaf ear, and
they're trying to get legislation, and that's refused.
Yeah, so one can decry the rioting, quote unquote, that happened on Monday, but it was inevitable. John F. Kennedy himself said, "Those who make nonviolent revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable."
Okay.
That's what they're doing right now.
Okay, and thank you so much. That will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Vam. Special thanks to my guest, LaToya Francis Williams, and Brother Cliff of Kuwumba Report. Thanks to our engineer, Mike Nacella, and thank you so much for listening to your station for Jazz and Justice. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace.